From South Dakota Public Broadcasting, this is Innovation on Dakota Midday for Friday, September 11th, 2015. I'm Kara Hedlund, and we're broadcasting from the studios at the Dahl Art Center in Rapid City. Today, we're meeting participants from the South Dakota Engineering Accelerator Program, which is a new program through the Enterprise Institute. The goal is to identify early-stage engineering projects and help them commercialize the technologies into viable businesses. Some of the projects include a plug-and-play USB device that provides precise indoor localization and orientation data for a variety of robotic applications. We'll learn about a new app called Crowd Control and a new portable generator. We'll also learn more about the Enterprise Institute. That's all ahead this hour on Innovation. First, this news. Welcome to Innovation on Dakota Midday. I'm Kara Hetland, and we're broadcasting from our studios at the Dahl Art Center in Rapid City. And we're going to spend the entire hour talking about the Engineering Accelerator Program. It's part of the Enterprise Institute. And joining me to start things off is Tom Eatrum. He's the manager of the Accelerator Program here. And his title actually is Manager of Angel Funds and Market Research, but with a very small staff, you get to do all things.
That's right. Thank you for having me.
Well, welcome. So let's begin and have you talk. Let's start first talking about the Enterprise Institute and what it is and where it's based.
Yep, you bet. So the Enterprise Institute is a private nonprofit corporation. We were founded in 2001 by the co-founders of Daktronix, Dr. Dwayne Sander and Dr. Al Kurtenbach. Really, the focus of our nonprofit is to help South Dakota entrepreneurs, specifically scalable entrepreneurs that might need extra coaching, resources, and a lot of times investment capital. They might not be bankable. So that's kind of the need that they identified when they created us. So really trying to help just South Dakota entrepreneurs launch, become viable, successful, and really grow the economy and hopefully have more entrepreneurs running around here.
What does it mean to not be bankable?
So to not be bankable is basically some of these companies, when people start them out, they're very high risk. They might be hiring, computer programmers or need a lot of working capital to kind of prove out their concept or build their company up. And if you would go to a bank, they would say, well, unless you have collateral to put down your house or something like that, we can't really loan against the idea or the concept. So sometimes you have to put in a lot of sweat equity, you know, which is basically just working your tail off to try to build it out. And then at some point in time when you need kind of that influx of cash or capital to kind of grow it, and the bank says no, you need to look at angel funding or you know, some sort of seed investment to kind of accelerate you to the point where you're successful enough that a bank will say, yep, I'll loan you the money.
And so the Enterprise Institute is based in three locations?
Yep. So we're headquartered in Brookings, and then we have an office here in Rapid City at the Black Hills Business Development Center, and then also an office in Sioux Falls at the South Dakota Technology Business Center.
Okay. And the Enterprise Institute's number one, I mean, it's to help entrepreneurs, but the accelerator boot camps, is that part of the Enterprise Institute, or how does that work?
Yep. So the South Dakota Engineering Accelerator is a program that we were lucky to receive a $100,000 innovation grant from the Blackstone Charitable Foundation, based in New York City, to really create and pilot this engineering accelerator program, which is focusing on, you know, engineering concepts, very technical projects out of the pilot program is at the South Dakota School of Mines and Technology. To hopefully see if we can give them some, you know, extra resources, mentorship, to hopefully turn their project or, you know, invention into a real-life viable business that can move out of the university research and into something where they're selling product or have customers.
And this is different from the Accelerator Boot Camp that, you know, we do a regular show there. We have for the last 5 years or so, and this is different how? Because it's engineering based?
Yeah, really focused on kind of these very early stage engineering concepts. They might have, you know, it might be a benchtop invention that, you know, a faculty member at a university has created, but hasn't really looked at identifying the market or how or what way you could introduce it to the market so that it could become, you know, a business that can create, you know, revenues and have employees rather than just a research project. So it's kind of early stage and really trying to coach them to see where this might fit to become, you know, something that's outside of just a research project.
And so right now you're in the pilot stage, right?
Yep. So we piloted it this year with that grant. So we actually had a week-long boot camp with 12 teams, selected teams. We had over 30 entrepreneurs comprising those teams, and had over 10 mentors kind of come in, subject matter experts, talk about different portions of the business plan, what you need to know. So we kicked it off in June with the week-long boot camp, and then have been working with the teams to identify other needs, mentors, different things like that.
And how? And so you said you had 12 teams. How many people applied? Was it a popular thing?
Yeah, we had over kind of 20 applications, technologies that were looked at and reviewed, and we actually had an initial goal of 10 teams, but we had kind of that overwhelming demand of things that looked pretty good, so we admitted 12 into the program. Which kind of looked like there was a little pent-up demand for something like this. So hopefully in future years we can continue that on and try to spin out more companies.
And the Enterprise Institute, how is it funded in versus kind of economic impact return that you get on helping these businesses?
Yeah, so we're funded in a kind of a variety of different ways. Like a grant like this allows us to kind of expand what our normal working focus is, to see, identify the need and say, okay, we have the funds to do it and pilot it and hopefully prove that this is something that can be successful and replicatable in future years. We also work closely with the Small Business Development Center and as a partner. And then our board is generous and actually donates money toward our budget every year. And then we have some fee-for-service market research tools for people that want patent searches or really just trying to build out a business plan.
Mm-hmm.
So it's kind of a variety of different ways.
So if you're an entrepreneur, you have a lot of support. Does everybody really know, though, where to go? I mean, is the Enterprise Institute, is that a one-stop shop, or do you have to go to different other agencies as well?
At different levels, there's a lot of resource providers in South Dakota that can help people on a variety of different things. But most of the partners that we work with, it's really a no wrong door policy. If someone comes to us and we're not the right person for them, we typically know who in the state can help them, and we'll make kind of that warm referral over to them. And say, hey, that's a great idea. You should go work with this person right now. And then when you identify that you need angel capital from one of our angel funds, please come back and we'll introduce you to that process. So the ecosystem in South Dakota for really resources for entrepreneurs, it's very healthy, and it's very easy to get into the door if you want to try to start something.
Is it still relatively small in South Dakota, number wise?
Of entrepreneurs?
Right. Mm-hmm.
I think it's actively growing. I think you see kind of a landscape change over the last decade. People kind of went through the recession and said, maybe they got laid off or couldn't find work, and they've been wanting to try something. And entrepreneurship is looked at as a viable career path. You kind of control your own destiny if you're running your own company. And I think even just seeing kind of the rise in freelancers or just kind of single person shops that, have a very specific skill set, and people will pay for that. I think the ecosystem's constantly growing and only getting better.
Does every great idea make a great business?
It does not. It comes down to execution. Some of our angel fund members, they have a saying that it can be the greatest idea in the world, but if the management team or that person isn't the one to take it forward, they bet on the jockey, not the horse. They bet on the person doing it rather than just the idea. Because typically during the execution of your idea, your business, things are going to change, and the person needs to be able to maneuver around the obstacles and the hurdles to really, cross the finish line and become successful.
That's where the failure rate is highest?
I would think so.
Execution?
And sometimes jumping in without some proper planning or really having financing or funds ready is probably one of the failure points too. But anymore, it's very easy to bootstrap, which means, starting something for relatively modest cash and just trying to build out, some early revenues to prove that your business is functional and viable. And I think that's something that's only going to get cheaper as, internet
right.
services, software as a service, different things like that. You don't have to be an HR expert or a payroll expert. There's services that, you can offload that stuff even as a small company.
And so you can create an item and just sell it on the internet without really, do you really have to have a business plan and all of that?
No, not necessarily. You know, not necessarily. Some people say that, you know, do I really need to write a, you know, a business plan? Well, a lot of people have been successful without it, but I guarantee you they had, you know, kind of a business plan in their head. Maybe they never put it down to paper. Mm. We tell clients that, you know, part of the business planning process is just kind of identifying those questions that you kind of need to work out yourself before you kind of, you know, put too much work or effort into it. And it's really part of the process of just building out that company. Okay, what's your market? You need to identify your market. That's a section of the business plan. Mm-hmm. So it's, I think there's a lot of different ways that people can work toward that and have good planning. It might not be called a business plan, but it's, you know, it's somewhere in their head.
Yeah. It's in their head. So, you know, and that's the thing with entrepreneurs. They're the big ideas. They're the creative ones, not so much using the business side of your brain, right?
Yeah, I think, you know, there's a healthy mix of pretty much everything in there. But, I mean, you obviously have to have an idea or a concept or a service that someone wants to pay you money for. Mm-hmm. But then, yeah, there's the, you know, you have to have the big idea. But then the execution is very big part of it. I mean, you can't just say, hey, I've got a great idea, give me money. It's like, well, what's the exchange of services or, you know, the value change there? There's a few, you know, very few ways that a business is successful, and that's that you have to give me money to survive and exchange of services.
So. Okay. So let's go back to the engineering accelerator. And so you started with 12 teams, yep. And are all 12 still moving forward?
I'd say we're at about 9 or 10 right now. Okay. Just, you know, some people, their full-time position or something is taken over, and maybe they'll come back at another time. Or one of the teams, he got an internship at NASA for 6 months. So he's taking a little hiatus from that, and he'll come back and keep working. I was like, that's a good reason to, you know, take a little break. And he's hoping to be able to learn more stuff at NASA that applies to his project that will hopefully come back and have a better understanding of how to try to, you know, sell to NASA or something like that.
So these teams are professors and students,
yep,
pretty much.
A healthy mix of, you know, professors, you know, graduate students, undergraduate students. So it's really kind of pulled from, you know, all over the university at South Dakota School of Mines and Technology. So it was a very fun week-long boot camp to have all these different, you know, faculty members, students in there, and they're all very smart in their own technical expertise. We had, you know, stuff ranging from, you know, robotics to apps, but to like nano engineering, mm-hmm. composite materials, advanced manufacturing. It was really a pretty wide variety of engineering-specific technical projects.
And are you learning right along with them?
I am. You know, it's we come in as kind of subject matter experts on, you know, the business plan, the business side of it, you know, funding mechanics, different things like that. But get a crash course in nanotechnology and some different things, and it was very interesting, kind of eye opening, some of the things that are going on at you know, universities in South Dakota.
And so once this pilot program is finished, then what's the next step?
So after kind of the initial part of the program, what we're doing now is really working with the teams to identify additional resources, try to build out that plan and take tangible, you know, items and cross them off the list that are moving it toward a viable business. And then the hope is that some of them would apply to the Governor's Giant Vision Business Plan competition, which can also win you some seed capital to keep moving forward. And then after that, just be there to help identify, you know, who do you need help from? Where is it kind of, you know, flow right into what we do in our everyday work at the Enterprise Institute, just working with entrepreneurs.
So this is going to continue?
Yep. We want to run it every year.
Okay. And so the other thing that's happening is we're bringing the Innovation Expo West River.
Yep, that's correct. We've been running the Innovation Expo in Sioux Falls for over a decade. It's, you know, it's a conference celebrating entrepreneurship. You know, people that are entrepreneurs, want to be entrepreneurs. We invite, you know, our angel fund members, you know, the business community, just kind of anyone interested in starting companies and really playing in that sandbox of entrepreneurship. So this year we've expanding it to Rapid City. We're actually holding them in the same week. So Tuesday, September 29th in Rapid City at the Holiday Inn Rushmore Plaza, and then Thursday, October 1st at the Orpheum Theater in Sioux Falls.
So, you know, the other accelerator boot camp, you know, the top gets to go and do their pitches.
Yep.
Is that the same thing that's happening here?
It'll be a little bit different. We're going to try to showcase the teams in kind of a video of their elevator pitches at mm-hmm. the Innovation Expo in Rapid City. just to the whole crowd so that people can see, you know, what's going on here in their local community. In future years, we'd hope to have some sort of pitch element like we do in Sioux Falls. So that's one of the partnerships that we have with the Technology Business Center in Sioux Falls is, you know, working with their accelerator program to showcase, you know, the participants they have at Innovation Expo in Sioux Falls.
And so because it's the same week, the, you know, a day apart, can you be at both, or
yep.
do you have to pick and choose?
No,
or it's
going
to be a caravan down the interstate?
It's a caravan. We kind of picked a few economies of scale there. We actually have some presenters that are presenting here in Rapid City that are going to present in Sioux Falls. So a little bit of cross-pollination, you know, try to show some people what, you know, what's happening on different sides of the state.
Okay.
So it'll be a busy week.
And who is it? Who is it for? What I mean, who is your intended audience for the expo?
Just current entrepreneurs, future entrepreneurs, and then people, resource providers, the business community. I mean, really anyone who wants to connect with, you know, those type of you know, big idea people, you know, people that are running businesses, wanting to start businesses, and then also students that have, you know, ideas or want to learn more about that.
How about economic development
yep.
people?
Absolutely, economic development. Most of the time we pull from the whole region and have a lot of the, uh-huh. the EDC development directors from a variety of different towns at Expo Sioux Falls, and we'll have them here at Rapid City as well.
Okay, so we're going to hear shortened little pitches about three programs
yep.
That are going through the accelerator. Any reason you picked these three?
You know, they were willing for one.
Okay.
And just really Ooh. Kind of exciting projects that they're working on. Just, you know, we've got an app idea. We've got a robotics company and actually, a reactor that's it's nuclear, but not the typical one that it's a huge plant. So there's some interesting things.
So it's a wide variety,
yes.
which showcases the variations
yep,
that you have.
Absolutely.
Okay, and thinking of expanding this to maybe to other universities over time?
Yep, we hope to potentially be able to expand it. We'll identify funding, and we'd like to have a program go through Brookings next year also, since really focusing on those engineering projects as well. So
okay.
Run it in tandem.
Tom Eatrum, thank you for taking time and coming on and helping set this up today.
Yeah, thank you very much for having me.
I appreciate it. And when we come back, we will meet the participants in the Accelerator program. You're listening to Innovation on South Dakota Public Broadcasting. And welcome to Innovation on Dakota Midday. I'm Kara Hetland, and we're broadcasting from the studios at the Dahl Arts Center in Rapid City, and we're going to take time now and meet some of the participants from the Engineering Accelerator Program. And joining me is Joe Mowry and Charles Bond. Thank you for taking time and coming in today. Appreciate it.
Yeah, thanks for having us.
So you are creating an app called Crowd Control. Tell me what this is.
Well, Crowd Control is our take on a problem that we had. It is a mobile application that helps ease the user experience of going out in large groups.
Okay. So you have a friend who always got lost. Is that
yes.
right? You
yes.
spent more time finding your friend?
We had a friend that a lot of times when we go out just couldn't manage to stay with the group.
And this app does, I mean, describe it for me. What am I going to see on my screen?
So what you'll see is kind of no big shock from what you'll always find in most apps as far as social apps and stuff like that. You'll find messaging in it. You'll find GPS location. Basically anything you can think of to, you know, find your friends.
Okay. And then does it like pinpoint on a map where they're actually standing or?
That's kind of what it's still in development, but that's kind of what we're aiming at is to be able to have a map that'll show waypoints of where, say, friend A is or friend B is, and a way to kind of get there.
What if you're just in a crowded room? I mean, does it just show that you're all together, but you're not really together, or how does that work?
Well, and that depends, I guess, kind of on the hardware of the phone. Some phones can have a more accurate GPS location than others, but most phones can get pretty close within about, 10 meters, I believe?
Yeah, it's somewhere between 10 to 12 for cell phones.
Yeah.
Okay. And how, I mean, you're still in development right now?
Yep. We're still developing the app. We've got a pretty decent UI made out right now. but we're still kind of hammering out a lot of details and implementation. So it's not really very close to coming out yet, but it's coming along nicely.
And how did you get involved? How did you learn about this accelerator program?
We learned about this accelerator program last semester. Software engineering. We had a competition with the class to win the Butterfield Cup for the best business plan. And this happened to be our business plan, and we decided that we want to take it into the future, want to see it actually become real and see people use it.
Okay, because sometimes friends just wander downtown. I mean, I guess I'm not into the going out scene in Rapid City, but that's what happens. They just kind of wander from place to place.
Well, if you go downtown, maybe sometime Friday, Saturday, it's pretty common to have a friend or two in a large group kind of get separated. And, you know, this app hopefully would eliminate that. And I think the best part about it is it's versatile, in which you can kind of use it for more than just going out. You can use it for, say, for instance, field trips, or you can use it for church groups. If you're part of a large group and you need to kind of organize subgroups of people, and you can kind of do that very easily.
So if you take a big trip to a large city and you...
Right, yeah. Right.
Huh, okay. Family reunions kind of thing?
Yeah, pretty much anything you can think of in a large group or even a smaller group if you just want to kind of see where people are at. And then one cool functionality it has, or will have, I suppose, is having a roll call in which, say for instance, 7 out of 8 of you want to go and you can't find that last person, you can hit a roll call. And it'll say, hey, and it'll send an alert to everybody and say, hey, we're leaving, so meet up wherever.
Yeah, this is where we're going. Yeah. Huh. Okay, so you're both what kind of majors at School of Mines?
We're both computer science majors.
Computer science majors. So this is you actually writing the programs itself?
Yep.
Okay, and how is this part of... something that you're being taught as you go along, or something that you already knew how to do?
A lot of it is new to us. I mean, you can only learn so much in school compared to, especially with such a large area like computer programming. So they teach you more how to learn. So when you actually have to go, like we're writing our app, we have the knowledge to be able to go out and learn what we need to know to write it.
Okay. Okay, so you're doing your own research on the side as to how to do this and create this.
Yeah.
Okay. And your imagination in what it should look like, is that...
Yeah, it's hard to kind of picture what the code is going to look like and how the UI or the interface that the user will use is going to correspond to that. But various classes have kind of given us a pretty good intro into that. But like Nick said, I mean, we just have to kind of take our ability to learn and apply it to what we need to learn, so...
Mm-hmm. See, I'm sitting here waiting to see what the finished product looks like, but you're still writing the code behind the scenes, right?
Right.
To make it do everything that I would want. But you're trying to anticipate what people want it to do at the same time, right?
Right. And to kind of see how, you know, the market changes, how technology changes, and kind of keep up to date with that while trying to move our product forward. So it's kind of a battle on two fronts.
And how is a business plan for an app different than, you know, a concrete item that you want to sell?
Well, some of the big differences is most apps are free.
Yeah.
So in order to push an app, it has to be in the price range people would want to use it for. So, and without weighing an app down with a lot of advertisement, it is tricky to define what you're going to be able to make for revenue.
Mm-hmm.
So it is a lot more of give and take, where you have to experiment with what you're able to pull.
And you have to also be sure that there isn't something similar out there, right?
We do, yeah. We've done a lot of research about competitors and apps that pull a lot of the same concepts, and none of them really... tackle the problem the way that we do. And so we made sure to be very, very different from the competition, and at the same time try to find a nice monetization scheme, I guess, that, you know, is free to the user at best and also leaves us something to work with, I suppose.
Mm-hmm. And is your idea already protected? And
right, yeah, we've got it all protected.
Since we're talking about it on the radio, I thought maybe I should ask.
Yeah, good call.
Okay, so nobody can steal this idea. You're moving forward.
Right. Yep.
Okay, so what are your next steps?
Well, I guess our next steps would just be keep on developing and keep on getting the implementation coded, and I don't know, keep working on the nitty-gritty stuff, because we went through the accelerator this summer, and it was that kind of got us up to speed on the business side, and so we've got that as a good foundation, and now we can kind of move forward with the technicals.
Okay, and then when do you think you'll actually have something to test?
So we're aiming at the end of the semester to have a good amount of working code to test, sort of a minimum viable product, and then by the end of the year, the school year, to have a pseudo fully functioning app and kind of roll from there, I suppose.
And are you working with a professor, or is it just a group of students with this idea?
It is mostly a group of students. We do have some alumni that we're using as mentors to go forward to advice. They are people that have been entrepreneurs in the past, so we go to them for advice. There's only one of them's only a computer scientist, so we're not really going for the code aspect, more along the lines of how to start a business.
Okay, and how to market it? Have you gotten into that part of it?
Yeah, a little bit. We've gotten a lot of marketing tips and business tips from, you know, both the accelerator and, like Nick said, also people we've met through the accelerator and other alumni who have experience in this kind of stuff.
Okay. And next year at this time, we'll have you back on and you'll have a successful app?
Oh, yes, definitely.
Is that right? Okay, so I'm going to need that piece of paper back. So we're going to do live radio, and we're going to actually do the switch. I want to thank you both for taking time and coming on the program, and we're going to bring the next group in, because this is all part of doing your little elevator switches on the air. So I want to thank you both, Joe Mowry and Charles Bond, for taking time and coming on. We wish you the best of luck.
All right. Thank you for having us.
Thank you very much. And while we switch out guests, I just want to remind you that Lakota author Frances Washburn is going to join the next Dakota Midday Book Club, discussing her third novel, The Red Bird All-Indian Traveling Band. It's a heartbreaking and funny account of the Pine Ridge and Rosebud Reservations on the verge of historic change. It's set in 1969, and Washburn tells the story of singer-guitarist Sissy Roberts, who is reluctantly drawn into an FBI murder investigation following a raucous 4th of July gig. Tune in for that special episode of the Dakota Midday Book Club. That's Monday at noon Central, 11 Mountain, right here on SDPB. And joining me now, let's see, I'm not quite sure who's joining me now, so I'll just have you guys introduce yourself. Go ahead.
I'm Daniel Nix.
Hi, Daniel.
Lisa Woody.
And I'm Joe Lillo.
Okay, and your teacher is coming, but not here yet, maybe, or no?
He had to go teach a class or something, so, I mean, some...
You're here, you're on your own, then.
We are on our own.
Okay, so welcome to Innovation. I'm happy that you're here. And so your product under development is a small device, and I'm going to let you take it from there, because that's a lot of big words.
A large device, actually.
A large device, okay.
We are developing a smart wheelchair to enhance independence in people with advanced loss of mobility.
Okay. So you're creating a wheelchair?
Yes.
Okay. And describe why we need this wheelchair.
Well, the current wheelchairs available just don't offer the kind of independence that a person could have. The technology is there, but just things like no obstacle avoidance, not being able to move sideways, not being able to find a solution for feet placement, semi-autonomous navigation is keeping people from having more independence in their home.
And this is for in-home use, right?
Yes.
Okay. So what does this look like? Go ahead.
So right now it is definitely in the prototyping phase. We've got a little robot to start playing with, basically, so we can develop some of the algorithms that we need. For example, like Lisa said, one problem that we have is just getting people that don't have good mobility of their whole body. So I guess wheelchairs right now are good for people who don't have full use of their legs. But imagine that you don't have full use of your arms. Right now, a wheelchair doesn't really serve that purpose. But with what we're developing, even if you don't have fine control over your wrist to control a little joystick, you'd be able to use the device and it would keep you from bumping into things and give you mobility, even if you don't have full control of the chair yourself.
Okay, so what then, how do you move it if you don't have full use?
So right now, we're starting with sort of the same joystick idea, but instead of just running the controls straight from your hand to the wheelchair will sort of act as a buffer between you and the world that you're moving in. So if you're trying to get around your house and you want to, let's say, get around in your kitchen and say there's an island in the way, if you're trying to get from one side of the island to the other, with the chairs we have now, you would need to use the stick to turn the chair, go forward, turn it again, and just slowly maneuver around this obstacle in the middle of your kitchen. With the system that we're building, you could basically be able to take the joystick, point it in the direction that you want to go, say to the refrigerator, and it would figure out the whole path around the island and the obstacles for you. So you don't need to have this fine motor control of your arms that you do in wheelchairs now. Like, one of the biggest problems with wheelchairs now is not having full control and running into things, and people have broken arms and legs because they don't have full control. And we really want to step in and help fix that.
So it's going to know what's in its way and go around. You don't have to maneuver around things. It's going to do it for you.
Absolutely.
Okay. And so I'm wondering how you knew this was a need.
Well, after we made a senior design project where we navigated people with visual impairments through a building, and Dr. Magoo came up with the idea of placing this on a wheelchair. My mom has multiple sclerosis, and it's so painful to watch her try to navigate around even the area where she lives. She's not able to reach things. She constantly runs into people or doorways, miscalculates where to go, and just that small lurch of the chair when you miscalculate it is enough to run into something, to hurt yourself, and that's very difficult and painful to watch. So I'm really hoping that we can fix that for other people.
And is this kind of the same technology as a self-driving car, self-driving wheelchair?
So it's a little bit different.
Okay.
In the home where we are working, you obviously don't have things like GPS. And so that's kind of been an obstacle that we've been trying to overcome, is how do you determine where you are within the building when you don't have something like a GPS. And what we've been using, like Lisa said, we were working on a project our senior year in college to help people with visual impairments get around a building. And so what we started using was cameras that kind of watched as you move through the environment. They kind of watch the things that you're moving by and infer how far you've moved to determine where you are now. So that's kind of been the driving technology behind it, is using cameras to determine where you are instead of something like GPS.
So cameras all the time, or just cameras one time to map the rooms?
Cameras all the time. Basically, the system that we're trying to imitate is the way that your eyes work. By having two eyes with some distance between them, you're able to tell both where you are based on what you see and also how far you are from it. Just for example, try covering one eye and then guess how far something away is. Like, cover one eye and try to put your finger as close as you can to the table without touching it. It's really hard, but if you put two cameras together or simulate two eyes, we're able to essentially simulate how human vision works. And that's where a lot of our research is going right now. Into basically figuring out how to use two cameras optimally to figure out where we are and where we are compared to things that we've seen before.
So tell me where you're at with this with this device?
So currently we are in the research phase. We have another senior design team that's helping us design the mechanical part of the wheelchair. We're also researching omnidirectional wheels, where the chair can fully move sideways or in any direction, really. So still researching.
And you're all seniors or no?
We actually graduated. Okay. We're graduate students.
Okay. And so you're still there at School of Mines, right? Are graduate students there or where?
So I'm going through the robotics program for a master's right now, and that'll lead into the nanoengineering PhD program at School of Mines. And I really chose to stay there because of the great opportunity that we had the whole way through the undergrad program. The whole way through, we had phenomenal support from staff to really just pursue these activities that we might not get at a bigger school. We were able to work directly with some of the best professors we could find and really just make progress on projects that were important to us, not just the projects that were important to the school and passing classes. There was a lot more to it than just strictly the in-class academic side. There was a lot of personal drive to get through and just do the things that we love to do.
And Lisa, how about you? Where are you at as a grad student?
We're going to start in the robotics program in the future. Right now, we're still doing research just on and focusing on this project.
Okay. And Joe, you?
I'm in the same boat. Working on this project for now, and then possibly continuing school in the future.
Okay, so you took part in the accelerator program, and did you learn a lot about writing a business plan and those kinds of things, or?
Absolutely. When we first went to the accelerator, we were very much scientists in our approach to the whole business. An approach that a lot of scientists will take to starting a business is we were going to build this cool technology and people were just going to love it.
Mm-hmm.
We get into the business accelerator and all of a sudden we realize that we should probably have someone who might actually want to purchase what we're trying to build in the future. And it turns out eventually you actually have to make some money off of what you're building. Otherwise, it's kind of hard to keep it going.
Novel idea, huh?
Yeah, I know. It's crazy. Money to eat and have a house to live? I don't know about that.
So you're still in the process. So nothing quite yet. I mean, then once this is figured out and ready to go in your home, then can you take it anywhere? Can you take this technology anywhere? Can you take it shopping?
That's the hope, at least.
Okay.
For now.
That's the plug and go part, right?
Right.
Okay.
For now, we're kind of confining it to an indoor environment. So like your home or an assisted living facility. But the hope is that in the future, you could take it outside of your home as well.
Okay.
Yes, it will take a little bit of research to figure out how the wheels work on outdoor terrain versus inside your home.
Okay. Well, unfortunately, we're out of time because we're going to get the next group in here, but I want to thank you all, and I wish you the best of luck. We hope to have you back on with a wheelchair to see.
All right. Well, thanks for having us.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you very much, Dan Nix, Lisa Woody, and Joe Lillo, I said that right. Okay, and when we come back, we're going to meet one more accelerator participant. You're listening to Innovation on South Dakota Public Broadcasting. Welcome back to Innovation on Dakota Midday. I'm Kara Hetland, and we are at the Dahl Studio, Dahl Art Center, in our studios here in Rapid City. And joining me now is Conrad Farnsworth, and you have technology. Let's see, Farnsworth Downs Technology
is
the name of your business. So,
small modular nuclear reactors for humanitarian aid.
Okay, tell me more.
That's the long and short of it. Well, it all started when myself and my partner, Susie Downs, who's not present at the moment, we met while co-authoring a book, and she just said, "Hey, do you know anything about thorium?" And I'm like, "Yeah, I know it's an element." And basically, she sent me 30,000 pages worth of research that took place in the 1960s and 70s. And my mind was just blown. I mean, I'd heard about this type of reactor technology before, but I hadn't actually delved into the research behind it, and it was really solid what they had. And then funding ended up getting cut to the program. And so what our company is looking at doing is sort of picking up where they left off on a much, much smaller scale, using much more feasible methods and some advanced technologies to sort of work over the problems that they left us with.
Okay, so it, nuclear, but not really nuclear.
It's nuclear in every sense of the way. It's like a sort of a greener version of nuclear, so to speak. So what these type of reactors use is what's called a molten salt. Now, a traditional nuclear reactor, it uses what's called just solid fuel pellets, and they keep all the stuff in a giant pressurized vat. Now, one advantage to using molten salts is that it's at no pressure, so you don't have to specifically engineer these components to be able to withstand thousands and thousands of pounds per square inch. I mean, that's how you have these explosions at nuclear plants, is you have this overpressurization of your vessel. There's no nuclear explosions that ever happen in a nuclear power plant. It's actually physically impossible. What you do get with these accidents are high-pressure gas releases. Now, the advantage of going with a molten salt is that all of your fuel is suspended in the salt, and the salt doesn't necessarily boil off like water does. It's just this kind of molten, gooey mixture, so to speak. Yeah, and it's at absolutely no pressure, so you can get it up to thousands and thousands of degrees Fahrenheit and not have to worry about any sort of ruptures or leakage of any sort like you had with Fukushima. Now, the other advantage, the other technology that we're looking at utilizing is the thorium fuel cycle. Now, with traditional uranium, you collect thousands and thousands of tons of uranium, but only a very, very small fraction of that, like 0.1% of that uranium, is actually usable as nuclear fuel. So you end up throwing out 99.9% of what you mine. And then you get that into a fuel, and you only burn less than 1% of that in a nuclear reactor. Still, that's six orders of magnitude more efficient than traditional fossil fuels. So with the thorium fuel cycle, you get 1 kilogram of thorium, and that's exactly 1 kilogram of usable fuel material. So you have none of this inefficiencies in the process.
And no waste?
And the waste, instead of lasting millions and millions of years, it decays over the course of, say, hundreds of years. So we don't have to take, you know, geologic shifts into consideration when we're storing this stuff for disposal. We can actually store this in a fuel cask for a couple hundred years, and by then it's decayed to a low enough level where it's completely negligible. We don't have to worry about it.
And so, but do you still have people with a fear factor as you talk about this?
When you use the nuclear word, there's, you know, this automatic sort of knee-jerk reaction to it. And people often, like, give us really weird looks. And what our company is trying to do is sort of, you know, redefine nuclear. We want to shift the paradigm, so to speak. We want people to be less afraid of it and more recognizing, you know, of its capabilities. I mean, you know, we drive vehicles on a daily basis, but we don't recognize, you know, that we have an obviously higher risk of crashing a vehicle than we ever would of having a nuclear meltdown. I mean, you know, we're in full favor of all types of nuclear power simply because, you know, an incident's newsworthy means that, you know, the chances of one happening is astronomically small. You know, with that said, there's very high levels of engineering that go into these systems, and we believe they could be made simpler.
Okay. So you're developing this technology or picking up where the research has left off.
Yes, ma'am.
And then you're going to do what with it?
We're looking at packaging them in a much smaller size. So right now, our inspiration for this, Susie and I's, was sort of disaster relief. So you have these incidents like Hurricane Katrina and Hurricane Sandy, where you fly in aid in the form of diesel generators so you can generate your electricity on site. Well, the problem with that is you have to refuel those generators. Well, with a small compact reactor, you can provide, you know, heat, clean water, electricity, and desalinated water to a site for years and years. And then you have a truck come by, pick it up, and haul it off to do processing on the fuel and, you know, refuel it for the next disaster.
It'll last that long?
The energy density of nuclear fuels is, take the energy density of gasoline, you know, so you get a certain amount of energy per volume. Add six extra zeros onto that for nuclear fuel, and that's what you have just per, you know, unit volume. What the calculations have been, you use about one ping pong ball size chunk worth of thorium fuel for your entire life. Imagine all the thousands and thousands and millions of gallons of gas that we burn all condensed down to one ping pong ball size chunk of nuclear fuel.
Okay, so I'm just dumbfounded staring at you, trying to think of what to ask you next. And what level of support are you having as you move forward with this?
We're actually getting really warm welcomes to it. I don't know if you can tell. I'm fairly excited about it. I talk fairly fast when I get really excited. But we've been getting like enormous amounts of support. There's a group out of Wyoming called the Wyoming Lifter Energy Association. Lifter is short for these molten salt reactors. And they've been a huge help. We're actually working on condensing these 40,000 pages worth of research into something that's searchable and more easily navigated. So we've been getting like outside help from those people. And like everybody we talk to has been really receptive of it, to the point where we've given, two TEDx talks and one in Denver and one actually downstairs in this building in the gallery below. So, I mean, the fact that we've gotten so much support, means a lot to us. And really what it comes down to is the voter. Currently, what's stopping a lot of nuclear progress is the Nuclear Regulatory Commission. In the 1970s, it changed from the Atomic Energy Commission, which was promoting all this, nuclear power, so they could use it for warheads, of course. And it changed its name from the Atomic Energy Commission to the Nuclear Regulatory Commission. So that kind of, foreshadowed where the agency was going. So now we're, now this agency's like refusing to license any new reactors, and we're running on reactors that are 30 years old. These huge pressure vessels that, are under thousands and thousands of PSI have been running at that level, for decades. And we don't have any newer technology that's obviously superior to the old stuff to actually replace it. So what I like to put on people's shoulders is it's kind of up to us as voters to decide where we go next with our nuclear future. I mean, we have the keys in the vehicle to a future that's much cleaner and much more efficient and produces less waste, but we won't turn the key. And it's because our risk assessment abilities are kind of skewed.
And you're saying molten salts, but describe what that is.
Sure. Now, with a traditional nuclear reactor, you have solid fuel pellets. They're about the size of the end of your pinky finger. With molten salts, you take these fuel pellets and you shrink them down to, say, about sand grain size. And then you suspend them in a solution of, it's called FLEB, lithium fluoride and beryllium fluoride, which is a salt. It combines the two ends of the periodic table. And then what this salt acts as is sort of a carrier and a moderator. And it takes the fuel and it kind of picks it up and carries it. And what you can do is more easily control the reaction when it's in solution by speeding up the speed of the solution or slowing down the speed of the molten salt solution. So it introduces a whole nother ease of control to the whole process. And like we said, on top of that, it's not under any pressure. So we can easily transfer this heat energy to a non-radioactive steam generator. And if there's any rupture within the steam generator, well, the steam's not radioactive. So you don't have to worry about, tritium or any other radioactive isotopes making their way out into the atmosphere.
And then can this technology be used in other things, like my car? Or?
The minimum critical mass, so to speak, the minimum amount of fuel you need to make a reactor is actually fairly large. There's been conceptual designs about these thorium-powered cars, and quite frankly, I think we're jumping the gun. We've gone, A, we skipped B, and now we're clear at Z, somewhere. We need to develop and sort of incentivize this technology in its infancy. I mean, even in its infancy, it's orders of magnitude better than, the old technology that we use today. So you're going to see implementation, in the form of small modular reactors and even larger scale facilities. We have companies that are sort of, pseudo in competition with us that are actually looking at trying to replace coal plants on a one-off basis. And quite frankly, we as a very small company coming out of, Wyoming and South Dakota, we don't see it feasible to ask, investors for billions of dollars without showing any work. So right now we're working on a small scale prototype. We actually have all the parts for it in, and we're in the process of constructing it.
So you're about ready to prove it?
We're about ready to prove that the technology works.
Okay.
In order to circumvent some of the NRC licensing, it's not a radioactive prototype, but it is a prototype that'll operate at the temperatures and similar conditions as a full scale unit would.
All right. Well, Conrad Farnsworth, I'm sorry to say that we're out of time, but I really appreciate you taking time out of your schedule and coming on Innovation today.
Well, thank you very much for having me. I appreciate it.
Thank you very much, Conrad Farnsworth. We also talked with Joe Mowry and Charles Bond and Dan Nix, Lisa Woody, and Joe Lillo on the program today, as well as Tom Eatrum. And I want to say a special thank you to Charles Michael Ray for his assistance with the program today, and also China Lockett. Also thanks to Steve Zwimke and Chris Loffrey. Don't forget, a special episode of the Dakota Midday Book Club airs on Monday at noon Central, 11 Mountain, here on SDPB Radio. Lakota author Frances Washburn will join the program to talk about her third novel, The Red Bird All-Indian Traveling Band. You're listening to Innovation. I'm Kara Hetland. Have a great weekend.